Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Our guest today is Professor Kyle Swan, an assistant professor of philosophy at Cal State University, Sacramento. Go Hornets! Dr. Swan has been at Sac State, as it is frequently called, for the past 3 years. Prior to that, he earned a PhD under Lauren Lomaski at Bowling Green University, and then spent 8 years at the National University of Singapore. He specializes in the study of social, moral, and political philosophy, with interest in economics and religion as well. Mike has published more than a dozen articles on these topics in venues such as Religious Studies, History of Political Thought, Public Affairs Quarterly, and Journal of Markets and Morality, among other places. Many of these articles can be easily referenced from his website at Sacramento State, which will in turn be linked on our website, so please stop by and visit. Kyle, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks very much, Tony. I'm a tiny bit nervous doing this, but I've heard it helps to picture your interviewer in a large hat, so I'm going to try that.
Oh, yeah. I do have a large hat. Unfortunately, the earmuffs that I wear don't fit with that hat, so what you can do is picture me in reading glasses, though.
Will do.
I just had eye surgery, and I got lasers in my eyes. I'm just like Godzilla now, and I can, like, destroy cities with just a glance. So be careful out there. Anyways, today we're going to explore the topic of whether or not practicing Christians who take their faith seriously can also be committed liberals. Now, that term right there might cause a wee bit of consternation among some of our listeners, because that word liberal, as we use it in popular lingo today, especially in the United States during election season, has a different connotation than what you political philosophers and us historical political economists tend to have for it. So let's start out right there and define the term liberal. What are we meaning by the term liberal?
Right. I'm using it the way political philosophers do. And there's a long intellectual history, one that really took hold in the Enlightenment period, though, that aimed to make governments very sharply limited in their legitimate functions. And so primarily, they should be limited to protecting and preserving individual rights. And these rights are supposed to be understood in the first instance as liberties, rights to be left alone. So part of any liberal view of politics is that the state should protect specific liberties like speech, association, religion, movement, and so on. But a second part of the view is something called the liberty principle. And according to the liberty principle, liberty is a kind of moral default. People don't have to justify their speech or their movement or religious practices to any others. Instead, it's the people who would restrict their liberties who should be saddled with a burden of justification to explain why their use of coercion is legitimate. So I guess one way to put it is that morally speaking, you don't owe TSA agents an explanation of where you're going and why. They owe you a justification for stopping you. And then the third part is a kind of test for whether or not some justification for restricting liberty is a legitimate one. And generally speaking, the tradition has said that successful justification will implicate the idea that restricting your liberty is necessary to protect the liberty rights of others or something like that. But reasons for restricting liberty that cite like a putative common good or something like moral virtue or something like religious truth, these don't justify the interference. And sometimes philosophers have made this point by saying that the reasons that respond properly to this test should be neutral or non-sectarian. So I think those three things are features of an account of liberalism.
Okay. A question for you, and I don't really know the answer to this, and I don't know if you will either, but the term liberal today usually connotates something very different. Usually we point a finger at somebody and say, you're a liberal, you're a big government liberal, which is different than the term that you just described. Do you know how that term changed over the course of, I don't know, roughly the 250 years since the English and Scottish Enlightenment?
I guess a little. I mean, I think the change is mostly a change about what counts as having your liberty restricted. Like so what we're calling modern liberals, or maybe we can call them welfare liberals, suggest that merely being disadvantaged, even if this isn't the result of someone else's agency, counts as a violation of liberty. Why that change took place, I guess it became part of a certain strand of liberalism to care about what historical liberties did for people. And if they didn't do very much for people, then we shouldn't think of them as very valuable. And if we wanted these liberties to be valuable, they should be effective in some way. And that might be a kind of a germ of the idea of modern liberalism.
Yeah, it's interesting. And if anybody out there knows the reasons for this change in the lingo that we have here, I'd be willing to entertain that, because it's largely an American phenomenon. If you talk about liberals somewhere else in the world, they usually are talking about it in the terms of that classical liberal sense.
Right. But I think that dispute is mostly a kind of intramural dispute about whether we should be sort of classical liberals or whether we should be more modern welfare liberals. I tend to think of them as all liberals in the sense that they're on board with the first three things that I talked about. All liberals will endorse something like a liberty principle, and all of them will have some kind of test for whether or not a putative justification for interfering with liberty is justified if it's a good reason for doing it. They have different ways of spelling that test out, and they have other different subsidiary kind of concerns. But I guess they're all liberals. It's like a more of an intramural dispute than a more fundamental one.
Well, one of the questions that we're going to ask today, and it's based on the title of one of your articles, is can a good Christian be a good liberal? Before we get into the Christian part, what is the appeal of liberalism, say, for your typical lay person, maybe a secular person? In one of your papers, too, you talk about two different reasons for justifying liberalism. One is the instrumental or pragmatic reason, and the other is an epistemic reason. Explain the reason for the instrumental or pragmatic one, and then also explain to me what this confusing word epistemic is.
Right. So I just meant to suggest that there are reasons to be a good liberal that aren't based in moral principle. It can seem liberalism as a political theory could seem like, or a principle of political practice could seem like a nice compromise position to promote the interests of two distinct parties where neither can get everything that they like. And so you settle for some kind of second best with respect to your political goals. Or you just might strike a kind of deal like that to be non-sectarian simply because you fear being on the losing side of a political struggle. You can be very pragmatic, too. Epistemic reasons more have the idea that liberalism can be truth-conducive, right? And so the idea that people will find new and inventive ways to do interesting things if they're left alone, that featured prominently in Mill's argument in On Liberty for Free Expression.
What does that mean to be truth conducive?
A set of liberal policies would allow you to more likely hit upon true beliefs.
Mm. Uh-huh. And that would seem
it's kind of, you're making a prediction about what would be the best means to attain this valuable end of realizing the truth. So I think liberal policies allow you to investigate what you regard as error It allows you to be skeptical about a party line and subject it to scrutiny. And so every opinion gets to be sort of voiced. Maybe the true one will be the one that people come to adopt after this intense scrutiny and process.
Well, the search for the truth is always a really good thing, and I know Christians like to do that, so it sounds like this liberty thing would be a really good idea for Christians to go out there and be searching for or wanting. But apparently that might not be the case, because you have to write about this and talk about different debates on this. And you did this about a decade ago in a paper called Can a Good Christian Be a Good Liberal? And that came out in the Public Affairs Quarterly Journal. And then you also wrote one about a year later called Law, Liberty, and Christian Morality. And that was in the journal Religious Studies. And those two articles came to my attention thanks to a mutual friend of ours, Michael Thomas, an economist at Creighton University. So shout out to Michael there. And these also piqued my interest, since I'm writing some of my own stuff on the reasonableness of Christian democracy, or more specifically, Christian democratic parties. So this topic of why Christians would want to be liberals, or alternatively, on the other side of the debate, why they might not want to be liberals, is an interesting thing. So first question for you is, how did you make this topic of Christianity and liberalism part of your scholarly pursuit?
Well, I started thinking, it's something I thought a lot about when I was an undergrad at a small religiously oriented school. In the school, everyone had a dose of theological classes. And it was theology of a relatively traditional and orthodox sort. But it was also a school that's kind of known for championing political and economic freedoms. And these were understood in a pretty laissez-faire way. And that suggested to me, you know, this laissez-faire political and economic freedom suggested to me a kind of right to be wrong and do things that are wrong and naughty, as long as you don't harm others and so on. And so I started for my own personal set of commitments, I was interested in getting these two squared with each other. Now, an easy way to deal with this is to just give one of those things up. You can either reject traditional religious commitments, you can reject it as intolerant and opt for something more accommodating, but less orthodox religiously, right? Or on the other side, you can condition your endorsement of liberalism and say something like, error has no rights, right? That's sort of a thing that is part of certain Christian traditions. Error has no rights. But I didn't want to do any of those things, right? I thought the things I learned in my theology classes were basically right, and the things I learned in my economics and political philosophy classes were basically right. And so that's sort of what set me off in thinking about this more carefully.
Well, that's really interesting, and that's, you know, nowadays too, especially seeing this on modern college campuses, it might kind of be an odd mixture of the two things. How was this received? How's your work on this topic been received by the wider set of philosophical scholars? Is this a topic that everybody's pursuing now, or are you kind of an odd cat out?
No, I wouldn't say everyone. I think that it's been an object of investigation for a while. There are some that are like more theologically informed. There's a guy in the UK named Oliver O'Donovan who's written about things like this, but I think at least comes out on slightly, in a sense, a different side than I do on this. Among philosophers who are sort of theologically informed in trying to investigate this, there's a philosopher named Nicholas Wolterstorff who's written tons of things, and a younger scholar named Paul Billingham. He's at Oxford. And those are ones that are attempt and self-consciously attempt to be more theologically informed. In straight political philosophy and about the place of religious reasons in politics or in the public square, there's quite a bit. And I think that most people look to the public reason views of John Rawls as at least a kind of starting point. That is, if they want to start there. I mean, you can go all the way back to John Locke, of course. But another very good sort of philosopher approaching these issues is a person named Kevin Valier. So it's not a completely odd thing to do in philosophy, though there are parts of it, specifically the part where some of the work gets more theological, that isn't sort of standard fare.
Now, here's the question that I want to ask is first, not why a Christian, a good Christian, should be a good liberal, but why would Christianity and liberalism ever be at odds with one another? Sounds like liberalism sounds like a great thing, so you figure everybody would like that.
Well, look, I guess first I should be fair and say that it isn't just Christianity that does this, right? I mean, I think it's true that everyone, so on the one hand, I said, it's everyone kind of balks and gets indignant with others when others try to interfere with their chosen pursuits. So there is that kind of natural inclination for liberty. But I also think it's true that it's really hard to do this. It's hard to exercise restraint in the face of someone doing something that you perceive as wrong. Right, it's hard to be a good liberal. Right, it's hard for us to mind our own business. Liberalism requires significant restraint. It requires that when we see someone doing like the wrong thing, and it really irks us, that we exercise a certain amount of restraint. And I think most people, religious or otherwise, are kind of default legal moralists. When we see people saying and doing things we don't like, our first kind of natural inclination is to do something to stop it, right? And maybe it gets acerbated a bit when it's a kind of a religious view where you think you have like revelation from God that they're doing something wrong, and that gives you kind of maybe makes you feel better, more secure, that it's okay for you to stop them. But I think it generalizes outside of Christian believers.
Yeah, that is very interesting. You mentioned that we do have that, what I call the teenage impulse for liberty. We like everybody to just mind their own business and not ours. But on the other hand,
we have this meddling busybody impulse on the other hand.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my life is great, and if everybody could be like me, that's great. I'd give them the freedom to be exactly like me.
Yeah, so that's right. So it's kind of interesting, kind of, I don't know if it's an inconsistency exactly, but we get mad about something, the very thing that when others do it to us, the very thing that we sometimes feel inclined to do to others.
Well, that is a human impulse, but in Christianity, one could see how this could manifest itself real easy, as well as other religions, that if you're talking about the one true God and a set of commandments that you have to follow,
right.
It just seems to naturally suggest itself. Can you suggest some historical instances where Christianity and liberalism have butted heads against one another?
Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds there's a parade of horrors through history of Christians when they were able to get political power, using it in order to suppress things that they regarded as false or heretical or bad. Everyone likes to pick on Calvin for approving the execution of Servetus, who had some kind of unorthodox views about certain theological positions. And there were heretics who were burned and imprisoned and punished. These things are sort of par for the course in history.
You know, one of the things that you do really nice, too, in your paper from Public Affairs Quarterly, Can a Good Christian Be a Good Liberal, is to document a lot of confessional statements that occurred during the 1600s and 1700s, right around the time when liberalism was ascendant, so to speak. And you could see that, well, you know, back in the Middle Ages with divine right kings, it's not a big issue. But all of a sudden, when you got folks like David Hume and John Locke talking liberal stuff, there's going to be some folks on the other side going, whoa, 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 that's not what God wants.
Exactly.
Review some of those things.
I cited a few sort of confessional statements that were ones that dealt specifically with civil rulers, what they called the civil magistrate. And so in this, there's one document called the Scots Confession, and it reads, the preservation and purification of religion is particularly the duty of kings, princes, rulers, and magistrates. They are not only appointed for civil government, but also to maintain true religion and to suppress all idolatry and superstition. In the Belgic Confession, it says that God invested the magistracy with the sword for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. And they give a very specific, like, Christian understanding of evildoers and well-doers. Right? It goes on to say, their office is not only to have regard unto and watch for the welfare of the civil state, but also that they protect the sacred ministry and thus may remove and prevent all idolatry and false worship, that the kingdom of Antichrist may be thus destroyed and the kingdom of Christ promoted. So these documents give a very central role to the state in doing things that for us now seems like clear violations of conscience, right? And it's, reading these things, it's interesting, right? That they say that the state can legitimately go after even false religious beliefs, not just sort of bad moral practices. Most people today, I guess, most Christians today, think that there should be very broad protections for what they regard as conscientious beliefs, even if they're false religious beliefs. But the state can still go after violations of God's moral law. Many Christians have adopted that kind of asymmetry, right? They regard religious error as something that's tolerable, but moral error, where that has a specifically religious kind of idea, as intolerable. So there's been a kind of change with respect to certain kinds of error. And I think probably that change was mainly instigated by a reading of John Locke's arguments about toleration, but maybe we'll get to that.
Yeah, we will get to that. You also note another strand of thinking that sees Christianity and liberalism as being antithetical to one another, and that comes from a secular standpoint, something that you term laïcité, which comes from the French term laicism. What's the argument there?
Yeah, it's a kind of secularism, right? So there's a view. Well, when I talked about what liberalism committed people to, I said that it committed them to offering neutral justifications for interfering with others, if that interference is going to be legitimate. So there's a view that says that neutral justifications for interfering with others basically just means secular justifications. And so religious reasons for interfering always fail the relevant test for whether an interference with liberty is legitimate. But all kinds of secular values are totally okay, even if those secular reasons are also kind of sectarian and pretty controversial. So they say only those are appropriate to bring with you into the public sphere. Religious ones have to stay out. So I'm not saying that. That's not my view. I mean, I think instead that everybody gets to bring their views and values into the public square. But for a law to be justified, I'm saying, it has to be a law that's at least compatible with a person's beliefs, values, and commitments. If it's not, if it's a sectarian law in the sense that it only makes sense if you have certain sectarian beliefs, values, and commitments, then the law wouldn't be justified.
And that's where this whole issue of adhering to a principle of liberalism or liberty becomes very central. And that is what you do in your paper next. So go ahead and make the case for why a good Christian should be a good liberal.
Right. So I guess I'm trying to identify something that Christians should be committed to. And so, I mean, here are some things that I think that Christians are generally committed to, things that they have scriptural bases for thinking is basically right. So one is that Jesus, in some sense, is the ruler of all nations. So there's no inch of the earth that doesn't come under the lordship of Christ. That's a very common Christian belief. They also say that, therefore, civil rulers are supposed to be servants of God. They're supposed to govern in ways that God wants them to. They think that the civil ruler is sort of civil governments and laws should be committed to following God's mandate for the civil ruler. And so mainly what I do is I try to identify what that is and see if God's mandate for the civil ruler includes enforcing divine law morality, right? So I don't deny that civil rulers are supposed to be a servant of God. My argument actually depends on civil rulers being a servant of God. What I go after is the idea that to be a servant of God, the civil ruler must aim to enforce principles that are distinctive to Christian morality. And I deny that. And to do that, I actually do a little bit, or at least I try to do some theology, some honest-to-God theology, right? So I go to Romans 13, where the Bible says more about the civil magistrate than any other place in the Bible.
And go ahead and go there.
Oh, okay. it's a long kind of quote in Romans 13, Paul's letter to the Romans, and it's a kind of interpretive issue. One group of people reads it and they get the idea that, you know, God is in charge of what the civil magistrate does, and so that means that the civil ruler should enforce divine law morality. And I guess I have a different take on it. So I'll read the passage, right? Starting at verse 1, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment upon themselves. For rulers do not hold terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. Do you want to be free from fear of the one in authority? Then do what is right, and he will commend you. For the civil ruler is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. So I think a lot depends on, first, the kind of context in which Paul is writing here, and secondly, given that context, what these key terms mean, like evildoers, and what it means to do right and be rewarded by the civil magistrate for doing right. So it could mean like evil just means a a violation of God's law, rightness could mean here doing things that God commands people to do. But I guess I'm worried that that's not what it means, right? So first the context, I guess. Keep in mind who Paul is writing to. He's writing to Christians in Rome. And the way I imagine it is that you have these Christians in Rome ask Paul a question. They say, look, we're being ruled by godless, heathen, pagan rulers. Do we really have to submit to their authority? And that's where Paul comes in verse 1 and says, yep, you do. But what makes sense of that? So, right, the first thing to note is that the first sort of assumption I'm making is that this passage is going to set forth the duty or the interest, the power, the role of the office of civil magistrate. So it would apply to any civil magistrate. But it's not the case that any civil magistrate is going to be appropriately informed about or qualified to adjudicate over certain controversial matters in Christianity. If not, then that civil magistrate who isn't adequately informed won't be equipped to execute wrath on people who are doing things that are evil, where evil refers to specific violations of God's law. But if you think that God wouldn't set forth a role for an office where its likely holders aren't really equipped to discharge it, right, that would be kind of inconsistent with the wisdom and goodness of God, then you shouldn't think that God gave it to these Roman civil magistrates the authority to, or the role to enforce divine law, morality, or religious truth. That's not, I think, the best reading of what Paul is saying their role is. Rather, it's something more like things that the Roman civil magistrates were kind of doing, at least well enough. They were protecting people from various kinds of harms, enforcing a certain kind of civil peace. And so, as a kind of inference to the best explanation of what Paul says, really identifying them as God's servants, God's ministers, that means that they were actually fulfilling their role adequately. Probably that role is a better candidate for what the divine mandate to civil rulers is, this idea of protecting a civil and promoting a civil peace, right? So, I mean, another way to look at this argument is to say, right, the idea that the civil magistrates should enforce divine law says that God's mandate to civil authorities is to execute wrath on those who practice evil. And so that means to enforce godly righteousness. But, you know, civil authorities, the ones that Paul was talking about in the passage, they weren't doing any of that, right? They probably didn't know much about what God's law required. If they did know what it required, they probably would have smirked at it or thought it sort of silly. So, therefore, if this is God's mandate to these civil magistrates, then they were actually failing as God's ministers. But Paul says in verse 4 that they weren't failing as God's ministers. And so that can't be the thing that is part of God's mandate to them. So that's sort of the general form of the argument. The best reading of the passage about what identifies the role of the civil magistrate seems like an uncomfortable match with the context of that period in time.
Yeah, how does this then play out as we move throughout history, I mean, back in Paul's day, you had Caesar, and it was kind of a little dictatorial and stuff. But as we move into the more liberal, modern liberal period of democratic governance, where the government is supposed to reflect the will of the people, how does that all play out here?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the argument, the one that I just made, doesn't just apply to Roman pagans. It applies to modern pagans, too. It applies to modern folks who think that they know, they're kind of committed Christians and think that they know what God requires, but they might be wrong about it. Again, the idea is that God wouldn't assign a role for an office where its likely holders might not be very well equipped to exercise that office, that role. And so if giving the magistrates the power to enforce godly righteousness, but they're wrong about what godly righteousness consists in, that would actually make things worse. And again, that's sort of inconsistent with God's wisdom in assigning that role to that office. Here, the way that you sort of square, like the kind of exhortations that you get all over Scripture to do good and avoid evil, is to say, well, I mean, that should be something that you use persuasion with respect to. You use good teaching and good preaching, maybe even good church discipline to encourage conformity with, like, even every jot and tittle of God's beloved moral law. But, you know, force isn't appropriate. That's just not part of the civil assignment that God gave to rulers.
Yeah, I love that term jot and tittle that you use in your argument. So I'm glad that you used it there, because you make a really interesting case here, and I one that I find very fascinating, because the government is going to do a lot of things that you as a committed Christian might not like. From big moral questions about same-sex marriage, maybe all the way down to zoning ordinances or something like that. And there's a tendency to want to enforce God's will and use the government to do that, but that's not being very liberal here. Right. One of the things that you make a really interesting case about, and you just touched upon this here, you lead by demonstration, I guess, is that you can have a society that has religious orthodoxy within communities, but still have political liberalism coexisting with that. Explain that a little bit, because I thought that was a really great part of your argument.
Yeah, I guess that they're just, there would be certain things, like certain kind of controversial matters of value and belief that we should want the state to have nothing to say about, right? It's not because God doesn't care about these things. God does care about those things, but they aren't, and I think for good reasons aren't, things that God has made part of his mandate to civil authorities. Right? I think things like sexual ethics and same-sex marriage, these things are, according to a traditional sort of biblical Christian, these things are really, really important, but not the kind of thing that the state should have anything to say about.
Yeah.
It doesn't have an interest here. It doesn't have the authority here.
Yeah. And one of the things that your article makes clear is that, you know, Christians have to kind of understand that that's what the role of government is, and sometimes you have to live with that. And liberalism is a really good thing to have, but you might not always get the things that you want out of it. It reminds me of a quote from F.A. Hayek, which is one of my favorite quotes, and I'm just going to paraphrase it here, but, you know, if you get liberty, you're going to get a lot of things that you might not like, and so deal with
it. Right.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, it goes back to this idea that, well, it's just, you know, it's really hard to mind your own business. This isn't an easy task. It requires restraint with respect to things that you think are, like, really, really important. But look, we derive all sorts of benefits from living in a very diverse society, things that we couldn't have if we stayed sort of isolated with our individual sectarian groups.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to derive the benefits of a diverse civil society, then we have to learn to live with each other under a kind of common set of civil rules. These should be rules that everybody can get behind, mm-hmm. not ones that are distinctive to one sectarian view.
You expand upon this argument in your article in Religious Studies that you wrote about a year later, and that article is called Law, Liberty, and Christian Morality. And again, we'll point folks back to your website so they can get a gander at this article. You bring up something, a contemporary debate on this between two guys named Devlin and Hart. And it harkens back a little bit to John Locke as well about what is the proper role of Christianity in a liberal society. So discuss that, and how do you fall upon that argument?
Yeah, the Hart-Devlin debate was in the mid-20th century debate about the legitimacy of enforcing traditional morality, not necessarily religious morality, but the morality of the, probably what he meant was something like, this is Devlin's view, something like the view of most of the people, right, the cultural morality. And Hart was just providing a kind of, like a, just a white bread million response that sort of suggested that there are really good reasons for adopting a liberal view with respect to, in this case, it was sexual ethics and policies about homosexuality. One thing that should be sort of made clear, and this goes back to that kind of asymmetry I identified between the way most modern Christians identify, want to deal with religious error, and the way they want to deal with moral error. And they say that, well, we should have like broad toleration and freedom of conscience, even for religious error, but the state still has a very important role in promoting sort of divine law morality. And again, Locke's view kind of supports that. The view that Locke provided in his essay on toleration. He says there's a difference between policies that we can count on to really affect a change, right, and policies that really can't reach where they're going, right? So you can use force, an instrument of the state, to stop people from doing things that are bad, right? But you can't use force to change someone's beliefs, right? You can't use coercive rules to affect a sincere change in belief. And therefore, doing that won't bring about anything good, right? It won't bring about the person's salvation. And that has to come from like a sincere belief, a sincere change of mind. But it's interesting that Locke was challenged about this in a debate that he had with a kind of contemporary of his, a clergyman named Prost, Proast. And so there's all kinds of ways that Locke just gets this argument wrong, right? Because, look, you could use force to make people exposed to arguments for Christianity. You don't use force to make them convert, maybe Locke's right that you can't do that. But you could use force to make them give a hearing to the arguments for Christianity. Should we do that? Like you could use force to make them attend church and hear these arguments. That's something that you could affect. Or you could take like a longer term strategy. You could say, let's implement policies that focus on children instead of adults. And that policy might make it more likely that more of these children would grow up to be believers. Should we do that? Locke's argument doesn't rule it out. And you could use force to suppress heresy and false belief. You wouldn't do that to change the mind of the heretic, but you could be preventing the heretic from changing someone else's mind. That's another way that establishment principles could be effective, right? So certain policies could be quite effective. So what is the Lockean, either Locke himself or the contemporary adopter of the Lockean asymmetry, what do they say now? Right? When Locke was confronted with these kinds of arguments after his first letter on toleration, he actually wrote a few more and took a lot of the original argument back, like kind of conceded certain points. But the argument he came to rely on says, well, think about what you're saying the civil ruler should do, right? You're saying that the civil ruler should enforce the truth. But what if they're wrong about religious truth? What if they're pagans? Or what if they believe and promote a false religion? If making it a part of the role of civil rulers to do something would actually make something worse with respect to your goal, with respect to the goal of achieving, like, more followers of Christ, then that wouldn't be something that God would make part of the role of civil rulers. And so it's just something that just falls out of bounds with respect to what God has given these rulers to do. There's stuff that's part of the mandate to civil rulers from God, and there's stuff that just falls outside of it.
Mm-hmm. I find the arguments that you make in there so interesting, because not only do they apply to the Devlin and Hart debate, where you can see, well, yeah, religions were really kind of pushing certain moral requirements. They say, well, drinking is bad, so we're going to outlaw it on Sunday, or try to prohibit booze or something. Like, we know we can't change the alcoholics sinning internally, but we're going to create the structure around them that prevents them to do that. And so there's that tendency to want to get in there and tinker with, or have the civil magistrate tinker with the rules of society to nudge people, so to speak, into certain moral behaviors, or to expose them to that. But it's also something you see in the secular realm today too. I mean, in terms of here out in Seattle, we have a lot of nudging towards composting. You can't make me a internal environmentalist composter, but you certainly can fine me, you know, $10 a week if I have too much food waste in my garbage bin. Or one of the other things, you mentioned children too, and I couldn't help thinking about this. So many high schools out here require students to take a certain number of voluntary hours or volunteer service. And I just think that's kind of, you're requiring somebody to be a volunteer. That just kind of doesn't make sense. But it fits into this general thinking about, we want people to do the right things. Do we coerce them into doing this? How do you have your moral imperatives in a liberal society?
Yeah. So I just think that the sort of more traditional liberal response, the one that says that we should think that the civil rulers are authorized merely to enforce those rules that are necessary to protect people from things like harm and other sorts of intrusion, I think that's the best thing that we've hit upon. I mean, there's all kinds of literature about how these nudging policies lead to unintended and sort of negative consequences, that they don't work the way they were designed to work. But I mean, even if they did, you're sort of, there's something objectionable about substituting one person's vision of the good for your own. and making them comply with that.
One of the things that I thought about reading your paper, your two papers actually, and you don't touch upon this. You mentioned Romans 13 early on, but I kept thinking about the early Christian society, right? This is something that they really had to wrestle with. And obviously Paul is writing to all his fellow Christians in Rome at the time and saying, okay, you know, this is a sticky wicket that we have to deal with here. How do we do this? It seems to me that the first, I don't know, 3 centuries or so of Christianity was kind of a good model for how Christians could be good liberals, even when they're in a somewhat illiberal society. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I don't know if they had it, these very early Christians had it in their heads that there are these just sort of principled reasons to kind of not use the reins of the state to implement their views. It didn't come up because they didn't have the reins of the state. They were a minority. They were at some points they were persecuted. A lot of the time it was just keeping your head down and, you know, living a good Christian life as best you can. But I mean, it is sort of noteworthy that maybe not the very minute, but pretty soon after they had access to political power, they did use it to enforce a kind of coercive Christianity of a kind.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't immune to this.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I keep thinking about that, your argument about the pragmatic aspects of liberalism, and understanding that, well, when you're not exposed to the things that you want, you definitely want the freedoms for that.
That's right.
And that's just such a good lesson to remember. And yeah, and it's one too that they, you know, I recently wrote on colonial America in the Netherlands, is that religious repression kind of sucks. And if you flee it, it's not a good idea to impose it upon other people. So why don't we all just kind of get along and allow different dissent on theological views, and maybe you know, think about that in terms of moral imperatives as well.
I agree with that so much. Look, we all sort of have this. We all require sort of we issue a sort of a moral demand from others that they not interfere with our exercise of our agency.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, everybody wants this for themselves. But I think as soon as you acknowledge that this kind of comes from, this demand comes from just the very same grounds, everybody wants this for the same reasons that they've deliberated about what's good for them, they've considered the options, they've wrestled with questions of value, and after that, after exercising their deliberative agency that way, they've settled on something that they regard as good. Everybody does that. And so everybody has the same basis, the same grounds for demanding non-interference as anyone does. So there's something really weird, again, about someone who demands non-interference from others but refuses to extend it to them. In a sense, they're not living up to their own rational and evaluative commitment.
That is something that is really comes out in your writing, and I really enjoyed the two articles that we talked about. Now, you wrote those articles about 10 years ago, a decade
right.
or so ago, and it's been a while for you to think about these things. And one of the questions I always ask my listener or my guest at the end of the podcast is, you know, how doing the research has changed your mind on anything. So I'll ask you that. In thinking through these, did you change your mind in any surprising way? And then additionally to that, because it's been 10 years since you wrote these articles, has your mind changed on some of the things you've written since then?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And as I, you know, was sort of looking over these things and preparing for your questions, it did come to me that I think that I at least would offer some kind of qualification, right? I can't imagine a society that sort of self-consciously draws up a covenant to be a certain way, where certain values would be the ones that they inculcate there, that they make part of their, even their founding covenant, right? They might want to be a kind of city on a hill, right? Like the early Puritans did, where they self-consciously set up their society and its rules, where everybody agreed that they would be this certain way. And that just seems like an exercise of freedom of association. And I can imagine a society doing that. It would be hard to imagine a very big society doing that, because the problem of diversity always sort of seems to enter into it. But I could imagine a society that does this, and part of it is that they make their rulers do things that promote Christian truth and practice. And furthermore, I can imagine circumstances where that would be legitimate, right? Of course, again, I'm thinking about this now. You know, what to do with the issue of exit from such a society, and again, more generally, how it would come to deal with diversity as the society sort of moved and changed and later generations came up, and children who didn't sign on to the founding covenant grow up in it and object to it. How would these people be dealt with? Would the founding covenant that implemented these rules, would it have authority for these later generations, and how could it? How would it? So those are some of the things I'm thinking about now.
Well, that'll be interesting things that we'll have to keep an eye on. It's something that I've been thinking a lot as well, too, and I think there's a chance that you and I will meet at a conference on philosophy, political politics, and economics in New Orleans sometime next year. So looking forward to meeting you in person.
Me too, Tony.
My guest today has been Kyle Swan. Kyle, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
And thanks to you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.